It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. In December of 2003, after one of the most aggressive manhunts in history, U.S. military forces captured Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, hiding in a cellar near the dictator's hometown of Tikrit. CIA analyst John Nixon was the first agency official to conduct a prolonged interrogation of Hussein after the capture. Nixon had spent years studying the Iraqi dictator, but as he details in his book Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein, the man he found in captivity surprised him, and what Hussein revealed was a surprise to those who dictated the invasion of Iraq. And we welcome John Nixon to the program. John Nixon, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you were called in to ID the prisoner, Saddam Hussein, and determine if that's who it really was. Was there a concern that the person that was in captivity was an imposter?
Well, among a number of people in Baghdad at the time, yes. There was a belief that Saddam Hussein had body doubles. I didn't believe this. This is something for years myself and several of my colleagues had tried to dispel this myth. But actually, the more we tried to dispel the myth, it seemed like the myth grew even more. So there were a number of people who thought that, you know, we really need to make a positive identification of him because we didn't want to go public and then find out, of course, that it was someone else. Having said that, I will say this. The minute I laid eyes on him, I knew it was him.
What steps did you then have to take to confirm your belief that it was Saddam?
I was looking for certain physical markings and characteristics, these small sort of tattoos on his hand and wrist, tribal tattoos that would identify him. He also had, I was looking for a bullet wound, that or scar at least from a bullet wound, that he had suffered many, many years ago in 1959. And also I was looking for, he had this droop in the left side of his mouth. Years before, I thought maybe he had had a stroke because all of a sudden I noticed it. But then it really just turned out to be, I think, from a lifetime of smoking cigars. And so his mouth kind of just drooped to the side a little bit. And so I saw those almost immediately. But even more immediately than that, when the door opened and he was sitting there, there was simply no doubt in my mind that it was him.
Well, you knew the subject pretty well. You'd been studying Hussein for years prior to the interrogation.
Yes.
When you engaged him in conversation, once that happened, did you find the man you thought you knew from afar?
You know, that's a very good question. I think that we had done a very good job of getting to understand sort of the larger arc of his career and of who he was and of his regime. However, the more I got to know him and began to learn sort of the granular details of not only his life, but also the life of his regime, I really began to come up with some surprises.
There were a number of surprises. One of them was he told you he had been writing a novel.
Yes.
How did that come about that he revealed that information?
Well, we knew that Saddam had been writing novels, and the take at headquarters had been that, oh, these must be written by somebody else, and this is like a vanity project. And the person who came up with that interpretation was wrong on that count, because what was really true is that Saddam loved to write, and he considered himself a great writer. And prior to the invasion of Iraq by the coalition, he had been working on completing a novel, and that was taking up a great deal of his time. Saddam had become very disengaged from running the government on a day-to-day basis, and basically had turned over that function to several of his senior aides.
Was the impression going into the Iraq war that Saddam was completely in charge and that maybe even just removing him would cause the regime to just change over without as much of a long, protracted ground war as ended up happening?
Yes, I think that is true. The agency, we got that wrong in terms of, we always saw at the agency, we always saw him as sort of the master manipulator who was pulling all the strings and making all the decisions. And in some ways that was right. On some of the big picture items, Saddam still remained the guy who made the decisions. But on the other part, the master manipulator part, that was wrong, and he hadn't been like that for several years. And he certainly wasn't the way the Bush administration had depicted him, as a sort of a madman waiting to get these weapons of mass destruction so that he could blow up the world. And as far as what would happen after he was removed from power, I think the agency got that right in terms of, we told policymakers that a nasty vacuum would be created and that there would be a lot of bloodletting and violence. But I don't think we fully understood just how this would go on or how really nasty it would be.
We're talking with former CIA analyst John Nixon. He has written a book about his experiences interrogating Saddam Hussein called Debriefing the President. Nixon was the first person to do an extended interrogation of Saddam Hussein. I imagine one of the first things that you wanted to know from Saddam and one of the ongoing mysteries of that part of the war is, were there weapons of mass destruction and why didn't Saddam come clean about the status of them? What did you ask him about WMDs? Did you believe the WMDs were there?
We came right out and asked him point blank, do you have them? Where are they? Where are you hiding them? Tell us about your program. Were you trying to reconstitute your program? All sorts of questions. I mean, it was one of the most deeply covered questions, because this was the preeminent question that Washington wanted answered, and they wanted a certain answer, to be quite honest with you. You know, one of the problems with Saddam is that even when he was telling the truth, you couldn't help but feel that this guy was lying to you, because he was so secretive and so suspicious of everything that you did. It created a sort of a suspicion in yourself about him. And he basically said that he didn't have these weapons, he wasn't working on developing them, and he wasn't going to try to reconstitute his weapons program. And at first I didn't believe him. And we went at this kind of in this constant cat and mouse sort of questioning about this. Near the end of my role in the debriefing process, I began to have some doubts, but I still wasn't sure. And it wasn't until really I got back to headquarters and began talking to some of my colleagues and also going through some of the transcripts of what some of the other key regime officials had said who had been captured, that it began to sink in that maybe he was telling the truth.
The administration had the strong contention prior to the invasion that Saddam Hussein was playing games with the weapon inspectors, the UN inspectors. Was he doing that? Was he putting up a front for his neighbors? Did he want the world to believe he did maybe have these weapons?
I think that, as I said, Saddam was one of the most secretive people I've ever met in my life. And his secretiveness was a blessing and a curse for him. It kept his enemies off balance and kept them guessing about what his next move might be or what it is he had up his sleeve in terms of causing trouble. It was something that I think aided him in terms of being a smaller country or a smallish country in a neighborhood with some pretty nasty neighbors. But on the other hand, the secretiveness was a curse to him in the sense that he engendered suspicion and distrust through his secretiveness. And I think that's one of the things when we talk about the weapons inspection process, we asked Saddam, like, why didn't you just come clean? And his response was, but I did. I've told you repeatedly that I don't have these things, and you never believed me. And every time I offered to let you guys come in, you send people in and they start going all over the place and there's no control over anything. And from his standpoint, he thought that the weapons inspection process was riddled with intelligence services who were putting their people in there, not only to find out about Saddam's weapons programs, but also to find out about his military and his order of battle and other national security secrets, and was also trying to find out information about regime stability and Saddam's own security. And to be quite honest with you, he was right about that. And so it was almost natural for him to distrust this process.
And out of all of this, it would seem from what you write about, he said that he didn't expect the U.S. to tie him to 9/11 in any way because he didn't have the overt connection that was being sold prior to the invasion. Was he confused or surprised by the entire effort to draw Iraq into the war on terror?
Oh, my gosh, yes. He saw the United States as this massive, colossal country of great power and great intelligence that bestrides the globe. And he thought, naturally, it was an assumption, a deadly assumption of his. He thought it was so obvious that he had nothing to do with 9/11 and that none of the hijackers came from Iraq and that the only people who were flying planes into the buildings were Saudis and Egyptians and Emiratis, and that therefore the United States would have to draw the conclusion that the people that did this, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic extremists, we would have to know that the Sunni Islamic extremists were his enemy as well, and therefore that the United States would have to see that they had a common enemy with Iraq. And he couldn't have been more wrong, you know, because the Bush administration on September 12th was looking for the links between Saddam and the 9/11 attackers. And it was really a fatal misreading of international politics and also of America.
Well, when you got this information directly from Saddam Hussein, and I imagine that information went to the president pretty quickly, did you see any feedback or any change in some of the contentions about WMDs or policy regarding the invasion after this interview?
No. There was no, well, I shouldn't say that. I would say the feedback that I got was one of sort of resignation and great sadness and a feeling of utter disappointment that somehow we hadn't found something, and we were kind of looked on as failures for not finding this, for not proving the unprovable. And I remember thinking it was really weird when I came back to the United States that nobody really wanted to talk to me about this. And, you know, and for years, the only time I ever really talked about this was to incoming new analysts who were being trained, and they would sort of trot me out to sort of give them a pep talk about, you know, if you play your cards right, you'll get to do things like this as a CIA analyst. To be honest, and well, to be fair, the administration, in 2004, all of a sudden, there were a number of things that just sort of happened that, you know, like the Abu Ghraib scandal and the killing of the contractors in Fallujah, where their bodies were strung up on a bridge, and then the Sadrist uprising, the Shia Sadrist uprising in Najaf in the spring, that all of a sudden Saddam seemed like ancient history, and now we were onto something new and something worse. But to be quite honest with you, there was also this feeling in the White House, and I heard this from the feedback from one of the briefers who would go in to see the president every day, was that, you know, once he was caught, the Bush administration, really, their initial inclination was, all right, this is a solved problem. You know, we don't need to know anything about Iraq anymore because, you know, this issue is closed now. And it couldn't be, for all of Saddam's mistakes, we made just as many mistakes in understanding the situation.
Eventually, though, you did speak with President Bush about this briefing. You were talking to him about something else, but at one point the subject did arise. What did he want to know about your interrogation of Saddam Hussein when you eventually did see him face to face?
Well, he wanted to know what kind of man he was, what my estimation of him was as a leader and also as an individual. And he wanted to know if he knew that he was going to be executed. And he asked me a few more questions, but it was kind of a strange sort of surreal setting. This was about 5 years after Saddam's removal from power, and it had been prompted by, the questions were prompted simply because I was in the Oval Office, as you said, I was briefing about another topic, and the Director of National Intelligence mentioned to him, to the President, that I had been the first to debrief Saddam. And, you know, when I was leaving the Oval Office that day, I remember it was a really weird thing. I had heard of President Bush's sort of habit of using inappropriate humor at times. And he just kind of turned to me as I'm walking out and he said, "He didn't tell you where he was hiding any of those vials of anthrax, did he?" And everybody laughed. And, you know, I thought, gosh, this is, you know, this is not a time to be making jokes. This war has gone terribly wrong. And, you know, there are thousands of young men and women have been killed or maimed or, you know, are not coming back the same way they left. And, you know, I found it to be really kind of upsetting.
In the overarching narrative, they really do pin a lot of the WMD rationale being incorrect on intelligence gathering, on CIA failures. Do you think it's less of a case of the intelligence that was gathered and more of the administration cherry-picking that intelligence, looking for things that confirmed what they thought they knew, confirmation bias? And when you see the discussion right now about the role of the CIA in this Russian hacking matter, do you think that we are risking kind of a similar problem, that political ends are looking for intelligence that supports only their agenda and nothing else.
Wow, that's a that question. How many hours do we have?
That's a big question.
You know, I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I'm going to say, you know, were we wrong or did they cherry pick the information? I'm going to answer both on that. We were wrong, but we had what we thought was overwhelming evidence. And even the evidence that, for example, there were disagreements at CIA about the evidence. But for the most part, even when I joined the CIA in 1998, you know, there was the strong belief that, you know, he was working towards a weapon of some sort. And even after the weapons inspectors got kicked out in 1998, that suspicion just grew. And certainly by 2003, there was a lot of information that was kind of bogus, but there was still this belief. And I think that the disagreements that occurred within CIA were more of trying to choose which information best supported our conclusions rather than did he or did he not want to have a weapon. In all of my time as an agency analyst and all of the briefings I sat in and with in the intelligence community and with our liaison partners, I never heard anybody question the fact that he was doing this. So we were wrong. However, I will say this also, that the administration did 100% cherry pick the information. If they heard something from us that they didn't like, they would go over to, they had created this entity, and the name escapes me, of this group in the Pentagon who basically were like a rubber stamp for the White House. And they would just, they took anything that was negative about Saddam and weapons of mass destruction, any report that supported their conclusions, and they just said, yes, this is true. And anything that would make it look more murky or that we question this assumption was just rejected out of hand.
It really seemed like from a public front, there was such a sliding scale in how they termed the WMDs. It seemed as if they felt if they could find one vial of anthrax somewhere buried in a pit in Iraq, that justified an invasion.
To speak to that point, I would say this, you know, it was almost irrelevant. WMD was almost irrelevant, really, to the administration's plans. Because even if we had found incontrovertible evidence that said that Saddam did not have a weapon, was not working for a weapon, and did not intend to try to build a weapon, and even if this evidence appeared and it was just airtight, the administration would have found something else. They came into office with a view that Saddam Hussein was unfinished business, that view was not necessarily compelling on the first day of the Bush administration, but it was a feeling that at some point we're going to have to address this problem. And when 9/11 happened, that's the key date when his fate is really sealed by the administration. And that is when I think that's the liftoff point for Operation Iraqi Freedom.
So do you think now, when there is a public question over CIA findings and other intelligence agency findings about Russian hacking, and that this topic is being played out in the public sphere, that it causes rhetoric that could imperil good intelligence gathering and how people perceive that intelligence gathering within the White House?
That's a very good question. Personally, I would have preferred that the administration, the Obama administration, who began looking into this and wanted the intelligence community to provide an assessment of what had happened. I would have preferred this had not been, and I think it was Capitol Hill that sort of leaked the story, and then I would have preferred to have allowed the process to work itself out behind closed doors, in which the intelligence community could have provided an assessment, President and his aides could have looked it over, and then they could have decided what they were going to do, and then maybe they could have, in an effort to be more transparent, have released findings from the assessment and shared that with the American people. But instead, this gets leaked, and then it becomes a political football, and everybody starts taking sides and digging in their heels. And once these things sort of get out half-baked into the public realm, you're almost certainly not going to get an answer. And it's become so politicized immediately that finding the truth is going to be almost impossible. And I think that the way this has been handled has really been very bad. But having said that, all of the faults of the intelligence community, and they are many, I still remain a believer in intelligence, and a believer that the president absolutely needs to have the best intelligence, and that the president also has a responsibility to try to protect the intelligence community from politicization. And, you know, they both need each other, and they can't do their jobs without the other's support. And that's a really important point to make, because if there is this wall of mistrust that builds up between the president and his intelligence community, particularly with a president who does not have a very good background in national security and foreign policy making, then I think we could be in for some really rough seas ahead. And certainly this is something that our enemies will test repeatedly and look to exploit.
You know, everybody really wants to impress their boss, and this leads, in most cases, to people advancing in their careers. Given this environment with an incoming president who has been openly critical of intelligence findings, does that motivate the operatives to then say, well, let's give this president what he really wants to hear? Much like what you talked about with what the White House was seeking in Iraq.
That's a really good question, because, you know, something that is a fine line, because it is natural to want to serve the president. That's what we do. We have to serve the president. That's our job. And yet the closer you get in proximity to the president, and I felt this even when I was talking with Bush and Cheney, there's this natural inclination. You feel like you want to, you know, this guy's got a tough job. You want to give him some good news, you know, and you got to fight that at all costs. Yes, you know, during this period of transition to a new president, the agency is thinking of ways that it can impress the new boss and that it can show the new boss, hey, look, this is what we can do for you. This is how we can help you. And that's natural. And that's a good thing, I think. It's just that once you get into the governing aspect, once the president takes office and he starts to govern and he starts to make policy, that's where the real danger is. And that's where the agency really has to, you know, watch it. The agency works best when it doesn't allow politicization into its products and into its functions. And having said that, easier said than done. You know, it's a political world, and it's very hard for this not to happen. And I saw it happen, quite frankly, and I saw it happen on many, many levels. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, where we've really fallen down in the past 15 years. And it's part of this whole scapegoating of the CIA for WMD and 9/11, when in fact there's blame to go around for almost everybody. And, you know, I think right now, as far as Donald Trump goes and the CIA goes, it would be good for them to just sort of wipe the slate clean and say, okay, let's get started. And this is how we're going to do things and go from there. But if it's going to be a sort of a war of words between the administration and the CIA, both are going to harm each other, because, you know, Trump will tweet something out and then that'll make the agency look bad. And the agency hates that, hates bad press. And then the agency will respond by leaking, selectively leaking things that are going to be damaging to the administration's foreign policy and embarrassing to the administration. And then once that happens, once that genie is let out of that bottle, it's almost impossible to put back in.
John Nixon is a former CIA senior analyst, and he is the author of the book, Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. John, thanks so much for talking to us this morning.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.